Sounds True presents Inner Engineering, A Yogi's Guide to Joy by Sadhguru, as read by the author. And now, part one.
Yasya Brahmani Ramate Chitta.
Inner Engineering, A Yogi's Guide to Joy. As Robert Heinlein says, one man's magic is another man's engineering. The four-letter word. Once it happened, a customer walking into Shankaran Pillai's pharmacy saw a man outside hugging a lamppost, his eyeballs rolling wildly. When he walked in, he asked, "Who is that man? What's wrong with him?" Shankaran Pillai replied, unperturbed, "Oh, that guy, he's one of my customers. But what is the matter with him? He wanted something for whooping cough. I gave him the appropriate medicine." "What did you give him?" "A box of laxatives. I made him take it right here." "Laxatives for whooping cough? Why on earth would you give him that?" "Oh, come on. You saw him. You think he dares to cough anymore?" Shankaran Pillai's box of laxatives is emblematic of the type of solutions being peddled all over the world today for those in search of well-being. It is the fundamental reason the term guru has become a four-letter word. Unfortunately, we have forgotten the real meaning of the word. Guru literally means dispeller of darkness. Gu is darkness. Ru means dispeller. The function of the guru, contrary to popular belief, is not to teach, indoctrinate, or convert. The guru is here to throw light on dimensions beyond your sensory perceptions and your psychological drama. Dimensions that you are currently unable to perceive. The guru is here fundamentally to throw light on the very nature of your existence. There are many spurious and dangerously misleading teachings in vogue in our world today. Be in the moment is one of them. The assumption is that you could be somewhere else if you wanted. How is that even possible? The present is the only place that you can be. If you live, you live in this moment. If you die, you die in this moment. This moment is eternity. How are you going to escape it, even if you try? Right now, your problem is that you suffer what happened 10 years ago, and you suffer what may happen the day after tomorrow. Both are not living truths. They are simply a play of your memory and imagination. Does this mean, then, that in order to find peace, you must annihilate your mind? Not at all. It simply means you need to take charge of it. Your mind carries the enormous reserves of memory and the incredible possibilities of the imagination that are the result of an evolutionary process of millions of years. If you can use it when you want and put it aside when you don't, the mind can be a fantastic tool. To shun the past and neglect the future is to trivialize this wonderful faculty. So be in the moment becomes a crippling psychological restriction. It denies our existential reality. Do only one thing at a time has become another popular self-help slogan. Why would you do only one thing when the mind is a phenomenal multidimensional machine, capable of handling several levels of activity all at once? Instead of harnessing and learning to ride the mind, why would you want to obliterate it? When you can know the heady joy of mental action, why would you opt for lobotomy, for voluntary cabbagehood? The other phrase that has hardened into cliché through overuse is positive thinking. When it is oversimplified and used as some quick fix mantra, positive thinking becomes a way of whitewashing or sugarcoating your reality. When you are unable to process real-time information and control your psychological drama, you seize on positive thinking as a tranquilizer. Initially, it may seem to imbue your life with new confidence and optimism, but it is essentially limited. In the long term, if you deny or amputate one part of reality, it gives you a lopsided perspective of life. Then there is the time-honored business of exporting human well-being to the heavens and claiming the core of the universe is love. Love is a human possibility. If you need a refresher course, you can take lessons from your dog. He is full of love. You don't have to go to outer space to know love. All these puerile philosophies come from the assumption that existence is human-centric. This single idea has robbed us of all sense and made us commit some of the most inhuman and heinous crimes throughout history. These continue to perpetuate themselves to this very day. As a guru, I have no doctrine to teach, no philosophy to impart, no belief to propagate. And this is because the only solution for all the ills that plague humanity is self-transformation. Self-transformation is not incremental self-improvement. Self-transformation is achieved not by morals or ethics or attitudinal or behavioral changes, but by experiencing the limitless nature of who we are. Self-transformation means nothing of the old remains. It is a dimensional shift in the way you perceive and experience life. Knowing this is yoga. One who embodies this is a yogi. One who guides you in this direction is a guru. My aim in this book is to help make joy your constant companion. To make that happen, this book offers you not a sermon, but a science. Not a teaching, but a technology. Not a precept, but a path. It is now time to start exploring that science, working the technology, walking the path. On this journey, the guru is not the destination, but the roadmap. The inner dimension is uncharted terrain. If you are exploring terrain that is unfamiliar to you, isn't it better to have signposts? You could find your own way, but who knows, it could take lifetimes. When you are on unfamiliar terrain, it is just sensible to take directions. On one level, that is all a guru is, a live roadmap, GPS, Guru Pathfinding System. And that is why there exists that infamous four-letter word. Just to make things doubly easy for you, I thought I would make it eight. Sadguru. A note to the reader. There are many ways to approach a book of this kind. One way would be to plunge directly into practice, to take a headlong dive into do-it-yourself mode. But then this book does not claim to be a self-help manual. It has a strong practical orientation, but there is more to it than that. Another way would be to turn theoretical, but this book is not an exercise in scholarship either. I have never read any of the yogic treatises in their entirety. I never had to. I come from inner experience. It was only late in my life, when I skimmed through some of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, those significant yogic texts, that I realized that I had a certain access to their inner core. This is because I approach them experientially rather than theoretically. To reduce a sophisticated science like yoga to a mere doctrine is just as tragic as turning it into a cardiovascular workout. And so, this book has finally been divided into two sections. The first maps the terrain, the second offers you a way to navigate it. What you're about to read in this section is not a display of academic expertise. Instead, this section seeks to offer a series of fundamental insights, insights that lay the foundation or bedrock on which the architecture of the more practice-oriented second section is built. These insights are not tenets or teachings, and they are most definitely not conclusions. They are best seen as signposts on a journey that can be made by no one but you. They are core perspectives that have emerged as a consequence of the state of heightened awareness that has been mine since a life-transforming experience 35 years ago. The section begins on an autobiographical note. This is so you know something about the authorial company you will be keeping should you choose to read the rest of the book. The section then unfolds into an examination of certain basic ideas, exploring, along the way, some commonly used and misused terms such as destiny, responsibility, well-being, and even more fundamentally, yoga. One of the chapters in this section closes with a sadhana. The word sadhana in Sanskrit means a device or a tool. These tools for exploration offer a chance for you as a reader to put the ideas discussed in those pages into action and see if the insights work for you. These sadhanas will recur much more frequently in section 2. I am often told by people that I seem to be a modern guru. My response to that observation is that I am neither modern nor ancient, neither new age nor old age. I am contemporary, and that is how every guru has always been. Only scholars, pundits, and theologians are capable of being ancient or modern. A philosophy or belief system can be old or new, but gurus are always contemporary. A guru, as I said earlier, is someone who dispels darkness, someone who opens the door for you. If I promise to open a door for you tomorrow, or I opened it for someone else yesterday, it is of no relevance. Only if I open the door for you today is it of some value. So, the truth is timeless, but the technology and the language are always contemporary. If they weren't, they would deserve to be discarded. No tradition, however time-honored, deserves to live on as anything more than a museum piece if it has outlived its relevance. So while I will be exploring an ancient technology in this book, it is also a technology that is flawlessly state-of-the-art. Personally, I am not interested in offering anything new. I am only interested in what is true. But I hope the following section will offer you some moments when the two converge. For at those junctures, when the conditions are right, when an insight is articulated from a place of inner clarity, when it meets a reader at the right moment of receptivity, an age-old truth turns explosively alchemical. All of a sudden, it is fresh, alive, radiantly new, as if uttered and heard for the very first time in history. When I lost my sense. Then I was a man. I only went up the hill as I had time to kill. But kill I did all that was me and mine. With me and mine gone, lost all my will and skill. Here I am, an empty vessel, enslaved to the divine will and infinite skill. In the city of Mysore, there is a tradition. If you have something to do, you go up Chamundi Hill. If you have nothing to do, you go up Chamundi Hill. If you fall in love, you go up Chamundi Hill. If you fall out of love, you have to go up Chamundi Hill. One afternoon, I had nothing to do, and I had recently fallen out of love, so I went up Chamundi Hill. I parked my motorcycle and sat on an outcrop of rock about two-thirds of the way uphill. This was my contemplation rock. It had been for some time now. A purpleberry tree and a stunted banyan had put down tenacious roots into a deep fissure in the rock surface. A panoramic view of the city unfolded before me. Until that moment, in my experience, my body and mind was me, and the world was out there. But suddenly, I did not know what was me and what was not me. My eyes were still open, but the air that I was breathing, the rock on which I was sitting, the very atmosphere around me, everything had become me. I was everything that was. I was conscious, but I had lost my senses. The discriminatory nature of the senses simply did not exist anymore. The more I say, the crazier it will sound, because what was happening was indescribable. What was me was literally everywhere. Everything was exploding beyond defined boundaries. Everything was exploding into everything else. It was a dimensionless unity of absolute perfection. My life is just that moment, gracefully enduring. When I returned to my normal senses, it felt as if just 10 minutes had elapsed. But a glance at my watch told me that it was 7:30 in the evening. 4.5 hours had passed. My eyes were open. The sun had set. It was dark. I was fully aware, but what I had considered to be myself until that moment had completely disappeared. I have never been the teary kind, and yet here I was, at the age of 25, on a rock upon Chamundi Hill, so ecstatically crazy that the tears were flowing and my entire shirt was wet. Being peaceful and happy had never been an issue for me. I had lived my life the way I wanted. I had grown up in the 60s, the era of Beatles and blue jeans, read my share of European philosophy and literature, Dostoevsky, Camus, Kafka, and the like. But here I was, exploding into a completely different dimension of existence, of which I knew nothing, drenched in a completely new feeling, an exuberance, a blissfulness that I had never known or imagined possible. When I applied my skeptical mind to this, the only thing my mind could tell me was that maybe I was going off my rocker. Still, it was so beautiful that I knew that I didn't want to lose it. I have never quite been able to describe what happened that afternoon. Perhaps the best way to put it is that I went up and did not come down. I never have. I was born in Mysore, a pretty princely town in southern India, an erstwhile capital known for its palaces and gardens. My father was a physician, my mother a homemaker. I was the youngest of 4 siblings. School bored me. I found sitting through class impossible because I could see that the teachers were talking about something that did not mean anything to their lives, Every day, as a four-year-old, I instructed my housekeeper, who accompanied me to school in the morning, to drop me off at the gates and not enter the building. As soon as she left, I would dart to the nearby canyon, which exploded with an incredible variety of life. I started accumulating a vast personal zoo of insects, tadpoles, and snakes in bottles, obtained from my father's medicine cabinet. After a few months, when my parents discovered that I hadn't been attending school, however, they seemed singularly unimpressed by my biological explorations. My expeditions to the canyon were dismissed as messing about in a rainwater drain. Thwarted as I often was by what I regarded as a dull, unimaginative adult world, I simply turned my attention elsewhere and found something else to do. In later years, I preferred to spend my days roaming the forest, catching snakes, fishing, trekking, and climbing trees. I would often climb to the topmost branch of a big tree with my lunchbox and water bottle. The swaying motion of the branches would transport me to a trance-like state, where I was asleep but wide awake at the same time. I would lose all sense of time on this tree. I would be perched there from 9 o'clock in the morning to 4:30 in the evening when the bell rang and the school was done. Much later, I realized, unknowingly, I was becoming meditative at this stage of my life. Later, when I first instructed people into meditations, it was always swaying meditations. Of course, I hadn't even heard of the word meditation at this point. I simply liked the way trees swayed me into a state beyond sleep and wakefulness. I found the classroom dull, but I was interested in everything else. The way the world is made, the physical terrain of the land, the way people live. I used to take my bicycle along the mud roads in the countryside, riding a minimum of 35 kilometers a day. By the time I came home, I would be caked with layers of mud and dust. I particularly enjoyed making mental maps of the terrain I traveled. I could just close my eyes when I was alone and redraw the entire landscape that I had seen that afternoon. Every single rock, every outcrop, every single tree. I was fascinated by the different seasons, the way the land changes when it is plowed, when the crops start germinating. That is what drew me to the work of Thomas Hardy. His descriptions of the English landscape, which go on for pages on end. I was doing the same thing in my head with the world around me. Even today, it is like a video in my head. If I want, I can replay the whole thing. Those years and years of all that I observed with vivid clarity. I was a die-hard skeptic. Even at the age of 5, when my family went to the temple, I had questions, lots of them. Who is God? Where is He? Up there? Where is up? A couple of years later, I had even more questions. In school, they said the planet was round, but if the planet was round, how did one know which way was up? No one ever managed to answer these questions, so I never entered the temple. This meant they were compelled to leave me in the custody of the footwear attendant outside. The attendant held me by the arm in a vice-like grip, pulling and tugging me around with him as he did his business. He knew that if he looked the other way, I'd be gone. Later in my life, I couldn't help noticing that people coming out of restaurants always had more joyful faces than those coming out of temples. That intrigued me. And yet, while I was skeptic, I never identified with that label either. I had lots of questions about everything, but never felt the need to draw any conclusions. I realized very early that I knew nothing about anything. That meant I ended up paying enormous attention to everything around me. If someone gave me a glass of water, I stared at it endlessly. If I picked up a leaf, I stared at it endlessly too. I stared at the darkness all night. If I looked at a pebble, the image would rotate interminably in my mind, so I would know its every grain, its every angle. I also saw that language was no more than a conspiracy devised by human beings. If someone spoke, I realized they were only making sounds. I was making up the meanings. So I stopped making up meanings, and the sounds became very amusing. I could see patterns spewing out of their mouths. If I kept staring, the person would just disintegrate and turn into a blob of energy. Then all that was left was patterns. In this state of absolute borderless ignorance, just about anything could hold my attention. My dear father, being a physician, began to think I needed psychiatric evaluation. In his words, this boy is staring unblinkingly at something all the time. He's lost it. It has always seemed to me odd that the world does not realize the immensity of a state of I do not know. Those who destroy that state with beliefs and assumptions completely miss an enormous possibility, the possibility of knowing. They forget that I do not know is the doorway, the only doorway to seeking and knowing. My mother instructed me to pay attention to my teachers, and I did. I paid them the kind of attention they would never have received anywhere else. I had no idea what they were saying, but on those occasions when I attended class, I stared at them unwavering and intense. For some reason, they did not find this trait particularly endearing. One particular teacher did everything possible to elicit a response from me. But when I remained silent and taciturn, he seized me by the shoulder and shook me violently. "Either you are the divine or the devil," he declared. He added, "And I think you are the latter." I was not particularly insulted. Until that moment, I had approached everything around me, from a grain of sand to the universe, with a sense of wonder. But there had always been one certainty in this complex web of questions, and that was me. But my teacher's outburst triggered another line of inquiry. Who was I? Human, divine, devil, what? I tried to stare at myself to find out. It did not work. So I closed my eyes and tried to find out. Minutes turned into hours, and I continued to sit, eyes closed. When my eyes were open, everything intrigued me. An ant, a leaf, clouds, flowers, darkness, just about anything. But to my amazement, I found that with my eyes closed, there was even more that grabbed my attention. The way the body pulses, the way different organs function, the various channels along which one's inner energy moves, the manner in which the anatomy is aligned, the fact that boundaries are limited to the external world. This exercise opened up the entire mechanics of being human before me. Instead of leading me to a simplistic answer that I was this or that, it gradually brought me to a realization that if I were willing, I could be everything. It wasn't about arriving at any conclusions. Even the certainty of me collapsed as a deeper sense of what it is to be a human being started opening up. From knowing myself as an autonomous person, this exercise melted me down. I became a nebulous being. Despite all my wild ways, one thing I did manage to do in a strangely disciplined fashion was my practice of yoga. It started one summer vacation when I was 12. A whole bunch of his cousins met every year in my grandfather's ancestral home. In the backyard, there was an old well, over 150 feet deep. While the girls played hide-and-seek, the regular game played by us boys was to jump into the well and then climb up again. Both jumping down and climbing up were a challenge. If you didn't do it properly, your brains could become a smear on the wall. While you were climbing up, there were no steps. You simply had to clutch at the rock surface and claw yourself up. Your fingernails often bled out of sheer pressure. Just a few of the boys could do this. I was one of them, and I was pretty good at it. One day, a man over 70 years of age appeared. He watched us for a while. Without a word, he jumped into the well. We thought he was finished, but he climbed out quicker than me. I cast aside my pride and asked him just one question, how? Come, learn yoga, said the old man. I followed him like a puppy, and that was how I became a student of Malladihalli Swami, as this old man was known, and got into yoga. In the past, waking me up every morning was a family project. My family would try to make me sit up in bed. I would keel over and fall asleep again. My mother would hand me my toothbrush. I would stick it in my mouth and fall asleep. In desperation, she would push me into the bathroom. I would promptly fall asleep again. But 3 months after starting yoga, my body started coming awake at 3:40 every morning, without any external prompting, as it does even today. After I woke, my practices would simply happen no matter where I was and in what situation, without a single day's break. This simple yoga, called Angamardana, a system of yoga that strengthens sinews and limbs, definitely set me apart in any group of people physically and mentally. But that's about all, or so I believed. In time, I lost all faith in structured education. It wasn't cynicism. I had enough zest and life in me to keep me involved in everything. But my dominant quality even at this age was clarity. I was not actively looking for inconsistencies or loopholes in anything I was taught. I just saw them. I have never looked for anything in my life. I just look. That is what I am trying to teach people now. If you really want to know spirituality, don't look for anything. People think spirituality is about looking for God or truth or the ultimate. The problem is, you have already defined what you're looking for. It is not the object of your search that is important. It is the faculty of looking. The ability to simply look without motive is missing in the world today. Everybody is a psychological creature wanting to assign meaning to everything. Seeking is not about looking for something. It is about enhancing your perception, your very faculty of seeing. After high school, I embarked on a self-study program at the Mysore University Library. I was the first person there in the morning at 9, and the last to be shooed out at 8:30 at night. Between breakfast and dinner, my only sustenance was books. Although I was always ravenous, I skipped lunch for a whole year. I read widely, from Homer to Popular Mechanics, Kafka to Kalidasa, Dante to Dennis the Menace. I emerged from that 1 year more knowledgeable, but with more questions than ever before. My mother's tears compelled me to enroll grudgingly in Mysore University as a student of English literature. But I continued to carry the cloud of a billion questions like a dark halo around me all the time. Neither the library nor my professors could dispel it. Once again, I spent most of my time outside the classroom rather than in it. I found that all that was happening in class was the dictation of notes, and I was definitely not planning to be a stenographer. I once asked a lecturer to give me her notes so I could photocopy them. It would save her the trouble of dictation and me the trouble of attending. Finally, I made a deal with all the teachers, who were more than happy not to have me in class. On each day of the month, they would mark me present in class. On the last day of the month, the attendance was registered. That day, I would enter just to make sure they were keeping up their end of the bargain. A group of us started meeting under a huge banyan tree on the campus grounds. Someone named it the Banyan Tree Club, and the label stuck. The club had a motto, "We do it for the fun of it." We would assemble under the tree on our motorcycles and talk for hours on a variety of subjects, from how to make Java motorcycles go faster than they did to how to make the world a better place. Of course, we would never get off our motorcycles at any point. That would have been sacrilege. By the time I was done with university, I had ridden all over the country. Initially, I traveled South India on my bicycle. Later, I crisscrossed the entire country on my motorcycle. Then it was natural to cross the national borders. But when I reached the India-Nepal frontier, I was told that my motorcycle registration and driving license weren't enough. I needed more papers. After that, it became my dream to somehow earn enough money to travel the world on my motorcycle. It wasn't just wanderlust. The truth is, I was restless. I wanted to know something. I did not know what, and I did not know where I needed to go to get it. But in my innermost being, I knew I wanted more. I never considered myself particularly impulsive. I was just life-oriented. I measured the consequences of my actions. It is just that the more dangerous they were, the more they attracted me. Someone once told me, "My guardian angel must be very good and perpetually working overtime." There was always in me a longing to test the border, to cross the edge. What and why were never questions for me. How was the only question. When I look back now, I realize that I never thought about what I wanted to become in life. I only thought about how I wanted to live my life. And I knew that the how could only be determined within me and by me. There was a great boom in poultry farming at the time. I wanted to make some money to finance my desire for unrestrained, purposeless travel. So I got into it. My father said, "What am I going to tell people? That my son is rearing chickens?" But I built my poultry farm, and I built it single-handedly, from scratch. The business took off, profits started rolling in. I devoted my 4 hours every morning to the business. The rest of the day was spent reading and writing poetry, swimming in the well, meditating, daydreaming on a huge banyan tree. Success made me adventurous. My father was always lamenting that everyone else's sons had become engineers, industrialists, joined the civil service, or gone to America. And everywhere, everyone I met, my friends, relatives, my old school and college teachers said, "Oh, we thought you did make something of your life, but you are just wasting it." I took on the challenge. In partnership with a civil engineer friend, I entered the construction business. In 5 years, we became a major construction company among the leading private contractors in Mysore. My father was incredulous and delighted. I was exuberant and sure-footed, adrenaline charged, and itching for a challenge. When everything you do is a success, you tend to start believing that the planets revolve around you, not the sun. And that was the kind of young man I was that fateful afternoon of September 1982, when I decided to get on my Czech motorcycle and ride up Chamundi Hill. I had no clue then that my life would never be the same again. Later, when I tried to talk to my friends about what had happened that day upon the mountain, all they could ask was, "Did you drink something? Did you pop something?" They were even more clueless than I was of this new dimension that had suddenly exploded into my life. Even before I had begun to process what it meant, the experience returned. It was a week later. I was sitting at the dining table with my family. I thought it lasted 2 minutes, but it was 7 hours. I was sitting right there, fully aware, except that the me I knew as myself was not there anymore. Everything else was, and the time flipped. I remember various members of my family tapping me on the shoulder, asking me what happened, urging me to eat my meal. I simply raised my hand and asked them to leave. They were accustomed to my strange ways by then. They left me alone. It was almost 4:15 in the morning when I returned to my normal senses. The experience began to happen more frequently. When it occurred, I neither ate nor slept for hours on end. I simply sat rooted to a single spot. On one occasion, the experience lasted for up to 13 days. I happened to be in a village when it began. This state of overwhelming and indescribable stillness and ecstasy. The villagers gathered around me and started whispering to each other, "Oh, he must be in Samadhi, a blissful state of being beyond the body, well documented in the Indian spiritual traditions." India, being the country it is, there was a traditional understanding of spirituality to which they were a heir that I, with my blue denim-wrapped brain, had no clue about. When I emerged from that state, someone wanted to put a garland around me, another wanted to touch my feet. It was crazy. I could not believe anyone would want to do this to me. On another day, I was having lunch. I put a morsel of food in my mouth, and suddenly it exploded. At that moment, I was able to experience the miraculous alchemy of human digestion, the process by which an external substance, a piece of the planet, was becoming a part of me. We all know this intellectually, that a part of the planet nourishes us, and our bodies, in turn, one day return to nourish the very same earth that once sustained us. But when the knowledge dawned experientially, it altered my fundamental perspective of who I was. My relationship with everything around me, including the planet, went through a dimensional shift. I grew aware of that extraordinary intelligence within each of us that is capable of transforming a piece of bread or an apple into the human body in a single afternoon. Not a small feat. As I began consciously touching that intelligence, which is the source of creation, seemingly inexplicable events started occurring around me. Things that I touched were transformed in some way or the other. People would look at me and burst into tears. Many claimed that they were relieved of conditions of physical and mental suffering just by looking at me. I found myself healed in a matter of hours of conditions that I would have taken months to get out of through normal medical care. However, I gave all of this little importance. This ability to transform my external and internal reality quite dramatically has continued within me and around me to this very day. It is not something I have ever tried consciously to achieve. It is just that once one is in touch with this deeper dimension of intelligence, which is the very basis of existence here, life turns quite naturally miraculous. In about 6 to 8 weeks, this incredible experience became a living reality. During this time, everything about me changed dramatically. My physical appearance, the shape of my eyes, my gait, my voice, the very alignment of my body began changing so drastically that people around me started to notice as well. What was happening inside me was even more phenomenal. Within 6 weeks, a huge flood of memory descended, literally lifetimes of memory. I was now aware of a million different things happening inside me in a single moment. It was like a kaleidoscope. My logical mind told me none of this could be true. What I was seeing inside myself was clearer than daylight. But I secretly hoped it was false. I had always seen myself as a smart young man. Suddenly, I appeared to be a clueless young fool, and that bewilderment was something I could not come to terms with. But I found to my chagrin that everything my memory was telling me was true. Until this time, I had completely refused to accept anything in my life that did not fit into a rational and logical framework. Slowly, I began to realize that it is life that is the ultimate intelligence. Human intellect is mere smartness that ensures survival. But true intelligence is just life and life, and that which is the source of life, nothing else. The world has been told that the divine is love, that the divine is compassion. But if you pay attention to creation, you realize that the divine, or whatever is the source of creation, is, above all, the greatest intelligence that you can imagine. Instead of trying to tap into this all-powerful intelligence that pulsates within each of us, we opt to use our logical intellect, which is useful in certain situations, but essentially limited. I also began to experience a heightened sensitivity to the feelings of others. Sometimes just the sight of an unknown person on the street in a state of grief could make me weep. I could not believe the states of misery that human beings were capable of enduring when here I was, simply bursting with ecstasy for no reason at all. It took me a while for me to realize that what was happening to me was something spiritual. I began to understand that what the sacred traditions and scriptures had extolled as the ultimate experience was happening to me, that I was experiencing, in fact, the most beautiful thing that can happen to a human being. Moment to moment, every cell in my body was exploding with nameless ecstasies. Right now, people glorify childhood because a child can laugh and be happy for no reason at all. But I saw that it is possible to be ecstatic in one's adulthood as well. It is possible for every human being because all we can ever experience happens from within us. I began to realize that the physical transformation in my appearance was actually a realignment of my entire inner constitution. I had been practicing a basic set of physical postures, or Hatha Yoga, since I was 12 years old. Those 13 odd years of yoga bore fruit at this time. Yoga is essentially a way of recreating the body so that it serves a higher purpose. The human body can function as a piece of flesh and blood or as the very source of creation. There is a whole technology for transforming the human into the divine. The human spine isn't just a bad alignment of bones. It is the very axis of the universe. It just depends on how you recognize your system. In my case, from being a physically intense person, I learned to carry my body as if it were not there at all. My physicality became very relaxed. Earlier, all that intensity was in my body. People could feel that if I entered a room, it meant action. But now, I learned to carry my body differently. And that is when I realized that this experience I had had was really yoga. This experience of union with existence, of oneness with all life, of boundlessness was yoga. The simple set of yogic postures or asanas I had been practicing daily was about physical fitness, or so I thought. But after that experience on Chamundi Hill, I realized that what I was doing was actually a process that could deliver me to a dimension far beyond the physical. And that is why I tell people, even if you get into yoga for the wrong reasons, it still works. There is something within every human being that dislikes boundaries, that is longing to become boundless. Human nature is such that we always yearn to be something more than what we are right now. No matter how much we achieve, we still want to be something more. If we just looked at this closely, we would realize that this longing is not for more. This longing is for all. We are all seeking to become infinite. The only problem is that we are seeking it in installments. Imagine that you were locked up in a cubicle of 5 feet by 5 feet. However comfortable it is, you would long to be free of it. The next day, if you were released into a larger cubicle of 10 feet by 10 feet, you would feel great for a while, but soon the same longing to break the boundary would return. It does not matter how large a boundary we set, the moment you become conscious of it, the longing to break it is instinctive. In the East, this longing has been culturally recognized as the highest goal of all human activity and endeavor. Freedom, or mukti, or moksha, is seen as the natural longing in every human being and our ultimate destination. It is just because we are unconscious of it that we seek to fulfill it in installments, whether through acquisition of power, money, love, or knowledge, or through that other great pastime of today, shopping. The moment I realized that human desire was not for any particular thing, but just to expand illimitably, a certain clarity rose within me. When I saw that everyone is capable of this, it felt natural to want to share it. My whole aim since then has been to somehow rub this experience off on other people, to awaken them to the fact that this state of joy, of freedom, of limitlessness cannot be denied to them unless they stand in the way of the natural effervescence of life. This condition of ecstatic well-being that has been mine since that afternoon on Chamundi Hill is neither a distant possibility nor a pipe dream. It is a living reality for those who are willing. It is the birthright of every human being. The way out is in. Everything you have done in your life so far has been in pursuit of a single thing. Whether you sought a career, started a business, made money, or built a family, it was always because you wanted just one simple thing, joy. But somewhere along the way, life got complicated. If you had been born as any other creature on this planet, it would have been very simple. Your needs would have just been physical. A full stomach would have been equivalent to a great day. Take a look at your dog or your cat. The moment their stomach is full, they are quite peaceful. But when you come into this world as a human being, things change. An empty stomach is one problem, hunger. But a full stomach, 100 problems. When our survival is in question, It is a big issue in our lives. But the moment it is taken care of, it doesn't seem to mean anything. Somehow, for a human being, life doesn't seem to end with survival. Life begins with survival. Today, as a generation of people, our survival process is better organized than ever before. You can go to a supermarket and buy everything you need for the entire year. You can do it without even stepping out of your home. Never before in the history of humanity has such a thing been possible. Things that even royalty could not afford 100 years ago are accessible to the average citizen. We are the most comfortable generation to have ever lived on this planet. The rub is that we are definitely not the most joyful, or the most loving, or the most peaceful. Why is this so? We have tried our best to fix the outside environment. If we fix it anymore, there will be no planet left. But we are still no happier than our ancestors 1,000 years ago. If it is not working, isn't it time to look at what is wrong? How can we continue to do something that has not worked for 1,000 years? How much longer are we going to live with blueprints that clearly haven't delivered their promise? It's time for a paradigm shift. Let us start with a single question. What do we consider to be a state of well-being? Very simply, well-being is just a deep sense of pleasantness within. If your body feels pleasant, we call this health. If it becomes very pleasant, we call this pleasure. If your mind becomes pleasant, we call this peace. If it becomes very pleasant, we call this joy. If your emotions become pleasant, we call this love. If they become very pleasant, we call this compassion. If your life energies become pleasant, we call this bliss. If they become very pleasant, we call this ecstasy. This is all that you're seeking: pleasantness within and pleasantness without. When pleasantness is within, it is termed peace, joy, happiness. When your surroundings become pleasant, it gets branded success. If you're not interested in any of this and want to go to heaven, what are you seeking? Just otherworldly success. So essentially, all human experience is only a question of pleasantness and unpleasantness in varying degrees. But how many times in your life have you lived an entire day blissfully, without a single moment of anxiety, agitation, irritation, or stress? How many times have you lived in utter and absolute pleasantness for 24 hours? When was the last time it happened to you? The amazing thing is that for most people on this planet, not a single day has happened exactly the way they want it. Of course, there is no one who has not experienced joy, peace, even bliss, but it is always fleeting. They are unable to sustain it. They manage to get there, but it keeps collapsing. And nothing earth-shattering needs to happen for it to collapse. The simplest things throw people off balance, out of kilter. It is like this. You go out today and someone tells you that you are the most beautiful person in the world. You are floating on cloud 9. But then you come home and the folks at home tell you who you really are. Everything crashes. Sounds familiar? Why do you need to be pleasant within? The answer is self-evident. When you are in a pleasant inner state, you are naturally pleasant to everyone and everything around you. No scripture or philosophy is needed to instruct you to be good to others. It is a natural outcome when you're feeling good within yourself. Inner pleasantness is a surefire insurance for the making of a peaceful society and a joyful world. Besides, your success in the world depends essentially on how well you harness the prowess of the body and mind. So in order to achieve success, pleasantness has to be the fundamental quality within you. Above all, there is substantial medical and scientific evidence today that your body and mind function at their best when you are in